All right, so we're going to start with tissues. Of course, the study of tissue is called histology. I can't remember what histo stands for, but it's for something related. So when we look at human tissues, there are four main tissues in your human body. The first is called epithelial tissue, and epithelial tissue lines everything. Just look at yourself and you're looking at epithelial tissue. So your skin is epithelial tissue because it lines the outer aspect of you. You have tissues that line the gut from your mouth all the way to your anus. That is also epithelial tissue. Your lungs are lined with epithelial tissue. So it's the liner for everything as far as that goes. The next is connective tissue, and the name tells you that as well. Connects, and it's everywhere. Now, the interesting thing about connective tissue, it can be everything from liquid to bone, hard as bone. Yes, so blood is connective tissue, and bone is like connective tissue, and everything in between. So we say it helps to protect and support the body and its organs, which is adipose tissue, which is fat, so that is considered a connective tissue. Its organs, it stores energy, helps transport gases, and provides immunity. So when we get to connective tissue and we define what is connective tissue, you'll understand a bit better why some of these things actually are considered connective tissue, because they meet the criteria for what we consider to be connective tissue. The third is nervous tissue. Of course, that's the nervous system. It's the communication cable of the body. It's how the body kind of talks. One way the body talks to itself, messages go from the higher centers to the lower centers to wiggle your finger or maybe diaphragm, contract to breathe, or whatever it may be. And then, of course, the muscle tissue, which we're doing in clinical anatomy, it's allows for movement, whether that's walking and moving the body or whether that's taking food materials in the gut and moving them along the gut. They do those. So those are the four tissues of the body. So you're either one of those four or many of those four at any given time. All those tissues come from three germ layers. So when we talked a little bit about mitosis, when we talked about through meiosis, we had gametes, which of course have half the amount of genetic material, and then they come together and create the full. Well, once that ovum and sperm come together and we have that single fertilized cell, then that cell goes on to divide and divide and divide. 1 to 2 to 4 to 8 to 16 and so forth, right? Then eventually what happens is they start to create embryonic tissues. So this is way before it just looks like a blob. We're not even anywhere near what you think of as a fetus. This is just these embryonic tissues are like a blob. Well, you guys, many of you here eat embryonic tissue.
Ew.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And in fact, at a certain point in your development as humans, you have a yolk sac. And the yolk sac provides nourishment, right, for development to occur. Who asked somebody the question?
Why do we say germ layers?
Germinate. To create.
Germinate.
Okay. Right. Okay. So we say all those four tissues arise from one or more of what are called the germ layers: the ectoderm, the mesoderm, and the endoderm. I saw a video. I was on something completely unrelated. I was searching for something to put on one of my slide sets. And there was someone on there that was doing a bit of a lecture on this. And I was like, holy crap. So it's quite simple. When those cells are dividing inside mom, okay, they start to differentiate a little bit into these layers of these germ layers. So we have the ectoderm. Ecto would mean, right? So these outer cells start to do this, okay? Then we get the mesoderm, which is another set of cells in here. And then we get the endoderm, of course, which one then would be this area here. So within mom, we have these cells that are developing into these three layers, okay? These three layers create everything in the human body. So if we continue with the slides, then we can say, well, you can kind of see it here. So this will let you know, this is the yolk sac. And here we have the endoderm, the mesoderm, and the ectoderm. A couple things to look at here. This oral pharyngeal membrane will become the throat and the oral area of the fetus. And this primitive streak will become the brain and the spinal cord. So it's already starting to develop to differentiate into, shall we say, nervous tissue.
This is all happening
within
the placenta?
No, this is what's the placenta hasn't even been really created yet. It's in the midst of working because, remember, when the ovum is fertilized, it burrows into the wall of the uterus. And within that, then it starts to get the nutrients and blood supply that it requires, and then you get maturation of the tissues, and you start to develop the placenta and the umbilical cord and so forth. But this is way before that. Throat and mouth, yeah. So, epithelial tissue arises from all three. So when we start seeing differentiation, so when we look at embryonic tissue, it doesn't know what it wants to be yet, is the best way to put it, okay? It has yet to decide, I want to be this, that, or the other thing. So when we think of epithelial tissues, they arise from all three layers, ecto, meso, and endo. Connective and muscle tissue arise from the mesodermal layer, so the middle one, and nervous tissue is derived from the ectoderm, the outer part. The basic setup of tissues is cells and the mix between them. So when we take a bit of tissue and we throw it under a microscope, how we determine what it is and what it does and where it came from is what kind of cells does it have in it and what is between those cells. We're going to learn that epithelial tissue is defined by itself, whereas connective tissue is defined by its intercellular mix. So epithelial is all about cells, and connective tissue is all about what you find in the extracellular area. And, of course, structure governs function. The number of cells, the type of cells, the type of matrix mix, and so forth completely influences what that tissue is responsible for. So we have tissue, cells, and matrix. The mix varies from tissue to tissue, and that's why when we look at a piece of tissue under a microscope, we start using those definitions of what kind of cells and what's between them to start to determine what it is. Now, when we look at epithelial tissue, there are two types. The first, as I said, is the liner of the body. So whether that's lining on the inside, so as I said, the gastrointestinal tract or the respiratory tract, so from your mouth down through your trachea into your lungs, it's all lined with epithelial tissue, a particular type of epithelial tissue, as well as your skin is also a type of epithelial tissue, but it's obviously far different than what's lining the gut or the respiratory tract. The other type is called glandular epithelium, and this forms all the glands in the body. Generally speaking, what kind of glands? Because we have two types, right? We have glands that secrete out into the open and glands that secrete into hormones that secrete into, right? Okay, so you have endocrine glands and exocrine glands. So your exocrine glands tend to be epithelial, not your sweat, your oil, right? Okay, and we'll get into those later. So when we look at epithelial tissue then, what we find is tightly packed cells with almost no matrix in between them. Kind of makes sense. If you think of your skin, I'm out for a bicycle ride, and I wipe out, and I slide along the ground, and I'm wearing a pair of biking shorts and a t-shirt, it's the middle of summer, we're going to have what's most often known as road rash, right? Why doesn't all the skin disappear? Because it's tightly packed together, and we're going to learn there's actually spots that weld or glue the cells together. And yes, I did damage to it. You know, you get the road rash, it's all bloody and everything else, but it's not like it's just disappeared. It's actually held on a little bit. And that's because these cells are tightly packed. The other thing we need, they need to be waterproof, generally speaking. So your skin, right, how wet are you underneath skin? Right. You know, there's an old saying that as humans, we carried the ocean inside of us. We came out of the ocean, but we carried our ocean inside. Okay? So I have had patients in the past that I've worked with in the hospital, elderly folks who've had long-term corticosteroids, and the skin has become so tissue-like that the fluid underneath the skin, it can't hold the fluid anymore, and the interstitial fluid is actually just leaking out on the skin because the skin is so thin, it, it's lost its integrity to do so. So we want these tightly packed cells to keep us waterproof, both to prevent things from going in and from things coming out. There are single layers and multiple layers. So some epithelial tissues are a single layer only, and some epithelial tissues have layers of cells. If it is a single-layered epithelium, it is said to be simple. If it has a multi-layered amount of cells, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 10 layers, that is said to be stratified. So single layer is simple, and many layers of cells is said to be stratified. Epithelial tissue is avascular. I always use the example, you know, when we're in elementary school, you've always got the idiot little boy who takes a pin, like a safety pin, and he slides it through his hand to gross out all the girls, right? And it doesn't bleed at all, right? That's because that needle has stayed in the epithelial layer and there's no blood supply there. So that's what we mean by avascular, right? When we do bleed, when we cut ourselves, it's because we go into the deeper layer of skin, which is not epithelial in nature. So what you're touching when you're massaging, or what's getting rubbed off if you have a sunburn and it's peeling away, that is epithelial tissue, okay? So it's avascular, and it gets its nutritional supply and removes its waste via blood vessels of the underlying connective tissue through diffusion, okay? Epithelium has a direct nerve supply, so we do feel, right? I can, you know, we can turn the lights out, and I can come up and gently touch you somewhere, and you're going to know that you got touched in one place or another, even though you can't see anything, because you're getting feedback from sensory organs that are embedded within that tissue, giving feedback. These cells have, though, a free surface. So what you are looking at is your skin is open to the outside air, so it has a free surface. You also have a free surface in the gut. So if we look at a cross-section, say, of an intestine, we have an outer layer, which is epithelial, and then we have a muscular layer. Okay, this layer here is muscular, but there's also a lining on the inside that's lining this hole in here. So this tube, think of like when you're cooking Italian sausages, right? Right, that Italian sausage is the connective tissue layer of the small intestine with all the soft tissue removed and just the connective tissue. And of course, then we grind meat or other things and we put it inside. So this is an epithelial layer, but this is also an epithelial layer. So we say the cells have a free surface known as the apical surface, which faces the surface, whether that's the lumen of an organ, the inside space of an organ, the exterior of the body, or the exterior of an organ. Okay? So it has a free surface. It's open to something. The bottom of the cell is the basal surface, and it's attached to something called it's called the basement membrane, or it can attach to another cell layer. We're going to learn as we go through tissues, and especially when we're looking at systems, okay, when we're looking at, for example, lung tissue, what happens is we have what's called simple squamous epithelium, and it's simple, which means it's one layer of cells, and we want that because that one layer of cells allows for gas to move back and forth, carbon dioxide to leave blood, and of course oxygen to go in. So we want just that single cell layer. So what we have is we have simple epithelium in the lung tissue, then we have simple epithelium of the capillary, and they share the basement membrane. So it's that sharing and the two single layer layers is what allows for easy gas exchange. It's not a big, thick layer of cells that the gases need to travel back and forth on, okay? So we say then the basement membrane, and when we get into PATH, which you will have me for in the fall, there's a lot of cancers, when we're talking about skin cancers, the basement membrane makes a big deal, because if the skin cancer penetrates the basement membrane, such as melanoma, that's when you run into big problems of metastases and so forth. So we always want to get at skin cancers before it gets down into the basement membrane, and it's less likely to cause too much damage or metastasize, for example. So we can see here in the peritoneum, we have simple squamous epithelium of the mesothelial lining of the peritoneum. So we'll come back to that, don't worry. It's just showing you for an example. We are going to talk about this. This is an example of a stratified epithelial tissue. You can see that we've got the deep connective tissue under here. Then we have the basement membrane, and then we have all these layers of cells here, right? This is your skin, generally speaking, okay? And you guys will learn to do, you're going to learn how to do connective tissue techniques next semester, right? And that's because you're going to be affecting this. And I do spend a bit of time on connective tissue because I think I've told you guys before, it's the new sexy tissue that body workers are working on is causing a lot of the problems, the pain patterns and dysfunction that people have because the connective tissue gets tight and dry and it doesn't work well, which causes a lot of problems people have. So we do a lot of connective tissue techniques to basically rip it apart and get wet again, get water back into it, and then it works properly, and then the patient finds a lot better range of motion, less pain patterns, that kind of stuff. The basement membrane is a thin tissue layer which bonds the epithelium to the underlying connective tissue. So I want you to think that when we look at the basement membrane, it's kind of like the glue. So we can have our connective tissue here. So this is your CT, connective tissue. Then we have our basement membrane. And then we have cells. And those cells can be one layer. I should make them closer because, as I said, they are very tightly packed together, but that's okay. Now, as we said, if it is one layer, I'm just going to do this, that would be simple. Okay, that would be simple epithelium. If I add other layers in, and then, you know, flat layer here, right, so we've got a number of layers here of cells. Okay, this, the whole thing here, this would represent stratified. Okay, everybody follow me? So single layer would be called simple. Multitude of layers would be called stratified. All epithelial tissue has a basement membrane, which is what glues the cells to the connective tissue below. So if you just grab the skin on the back of your hand and pull on it, you are in fact actually pulling the cells of the skin tissue and the underlying connective tissue. So affecting the apical layer of epithelial tissue does have an effect on the deeper connective tissue. And what you're going to learn is the deeper connective tissue is the same connective tissue that packages the muscle cells into the packages that we would call biceps, triceps, supraspinatus, infraspinatus, rectus femoris, and so forth. They're all surrounded by connective tissue as well. So if you affect this connective tissue, you're also going to affect deeper connective tissues, okay? You're going to learn a technique called skin rolling next semester. So it's kind of one of the first ones you'll learn. Now, this basement membrane is also divided into two layers. It has the most apical segment is called the basal lamina. So if I take this connective tissue here and I bring it down here, we have one layer and we have two layers of the basement membrane. Okay, there's two layers to it. The apical segment is called the basal lamina. Lamina just means layer. You're going to see lamina in a lot of places anatomically. It just means layer. Yeah. That better? Awesome. And then the deeper layer of that is called the reticular layer. So the reticular lamina. So the basal lamina is the most apical segment, and it contains collagen fibers and large protein carbohydrates known as proteoglycans. I'm going to get into those later. They're a very cool structure. They look like a toothbrush. And every bristle on the toothbrush holds a molecule of water. We And we want that. That's what allows, because if you grab your hand, it's kind of slippery, slidey, right? Things are moving good. But when we have connective tissue problems where people are tight and pain patterns, then those bristles on the toothbrush start losing water and the connective tissue becomes dry. So I come along and tear it all apart to reintroduce water into those bristles and rehydrate the collagen and the connective tissue, and it functions better. Just keep that kind of back here somewhere because that'll come up a little bit later. So choroidal glycans are related to the hydration of connective tissue, amongst other things. It does other things as well. The reticular lamina is closest to the connective tissue, and it contains reticular fibers and glycoproteins, which are similar to the proteoglycans. But these reticular fibers, so there are three types of fibers that are related to connective tissue. In this case, it's reticular fibers, hence the reason why it's called the reticular layer. Okay? So the basal membrane is further divided into an apical segment, the basal lamina, and a deeper segment, the reticular lamina. Okay? Epithelial tissue possesses several cellular junctions which will allow for adhesion of those cells, cell communication, so the cells can talk to each other through chemicals and so forth, and control of water flow in between the cells. So we're going to talk about those connectors shortly here, but obviously we want skin to stay together. We don't want it falling apart, so we have these really glue spots that hold the cells together microscopically. The last thing is epithelial cells, they die quickly and are replaced. So you are every day shedding an astronomical amount of dead skin cells, and they're constantly being replaced at the same time. Right? So when we get to the integumentary system, we'll talk a whole lot more about that, but just understand that the epithelial tissue has a high capacity for regeneration. Just think of if you ever cut the inside of your mouth, how long does it take to repair the inside of your mouth? Yeah, quick as hell, right? Because cells are regenerating very, very quickly and healing and repairing themselves. This is why the mouth heals. What's that? And just keep biting it, right? Now, the other thing, because remember I said epithelial tissue is all about cells, within epithelial cells, we find different shapes in epithelial tissue. So, there are three different shapes of cells in epithelial tissue. If the epithelial tissue is called squamous, it looks like flat tiles. Anatomically, they felt it looked like fish scales, and that's what squamous means in Latin. So they look like fish scales, so think of flat tiles, okay? Cuboidal, that name tells you pretty much the shape of the cell. They're cuboidal in nature, and so too does the next one, columnar. So column-like cells. So you either have flat cells, square cells, or tall cells in epithelial tissue. There is another type of epithelial tissue called transitional, and why it's important is because it allows growth of whatever it's part of. The prime example is the urinary bladder. So when the urinary bladder is empty, it's relatively small. And of course, as the kidneys throughout the day produce more and more urine because you're drinking water or whatever you're doing, and that bladder starts to fill up, and that bladder can fill and fill and fill and fill and fill. And it's able to do that because it has this transitional type of epithelial tissue, which allows it to grow quite large, much larger than you would ever possibly know. I had a gentleman I used to treat all the time, and he was quadriplegic. And he wasn't urinating properly, and he went into a merge, and his bladder went all the way up to his diaphragm. It had moved around the organs and gone all the way up. Yeah, that's how much it can expand. Yeah, because it just is able to expand. So we can see here, we've got a simple squamous epithelium. So if we think of the definitions we just went through, we have our connective tissue layer, and we can see it has blood supply in it. We then have our basement membrane, of course, which is the glue that holds epithelial tissue to the connective tissue. And in this case, it is a single layer, so it's called simple, and the shape of the cells are tile-like, so it's squamous. So because it has a single layer of squamous cells, it is known as simple squamous epithelium. Make sense? One layer simple, shape of cell squamous, so forth. This is a simple cuboidal cell. There's not a whole lot of places in the human body where you find this, but we do find it, and I'll be going into that as we move through. So again, connective tissue, basement membrane, single layer of cuboidal cells. And the last one is non-ciliated simple columnar. Let's not worry about non-ciliated for now. We can just see here that we can see very tall cells within here. Again, still a single layer, but just very, very tall cells. So hence, columnar or column-like, okay? One layer. So as I said, if there's only one layer of cells, the tissue is called simple epithelium. Now, simple epithelium is not a very strong type of epithelium. This is all about absorption and filtration. So anywhere where you have that kind of stuff going on, you're going to find simple epithelium. But it's not strong, so we're not going to find it in our skin, right? This is why when you learn how to do intraoral work for the temporomandibular joint, you have to be very, very careful, because the epithelial layer inside the mouth is simple, and therefore it can tear very easily, so you need to be very careful when you're working in the mouth, as compared to, you know, you can do a lot of aggressive stuff to your skin and it doesn't fall apart because it's not simple. If there are two or more layers, I said, it's called stratified. Now, this, any kind of stratified tissue is very strong, and it's able to deal with things like abrasion, but it's not good at filtration and absorption. It still can, right? Stratified tissue still can. So, for example, we've got nitro patches, we've got estrogen patches that ladies can use, you know, postmenopausal, all those sorts of things. So that it does, but it's a much slower rate when you're dealing with stratified tissues as compared to simple. Okay. There is a less common form known as pseudostratified epithelium. The reason we call it that is because under the microscope, just the way the cells kind of relate to each other, it looks like there's two layers, but it's not. It is a single layer, but yeah, just the configuration of cells makes it look kind of oddly like it is. This tissue appears to have several layers, but it's not all the layers just don't reach the apical surface. So we can see here, this is a pseudostratified ciliated columnar epithelium, basement membrane, connective tissue, single layer of cells, just some of the cells don't get to the apical surface. This is what lines your entire respiratory tract. That's the type of cells or tissue that lines your respiratory tract. And of course, those cilia, right, remember the wave and the power stroke or whatever, this is the stuff that can get the mucus up out of your lungs and you cough and spit it out when you've got like a bad cold or something like that. That's what helps you do that, okay? It's also the cilia that get paralyzed if you smoke. Nicotine does that. So I would assume that if you vape nicotine, it would be the same thing, right? And therefore, you're unable to cough up the mucus. Let's pretend it's not. Okay. As which? No, those are pretty glycans. We will get back to them. Don't worry. Therefore, when classifying epithelial tissue, you determine the number of cells first, single layer, simple, multilayer, stratified. And then you name it by the shape of the most apical cell. So in the case here, in this, do I have a picture here? Yeah, I do. Let's go back here for a minute. You can see this, okay? Would you say the cells in the bottom are cuboidal? Yes. And by the time they get up here, what do they look like? Right. So because the cells on the most apical level are squamous shaped, this is known as stratified squamous epithelium. So number of cells, simple or stratified, and then it's named according to the shape of the most apical cell of that tissue. In this case, the most apical cell is squamous. So therefore, it's a stratified squamous epithelium. That's a single layer. It looks double because they don't all get to the apical surface, but they're all columnar in nature, and they're only a single layer, hence the reason why it's called pseudostratified, because it looks like more, but it's not. Okay? So, junctions. So So think of this skin. Think of the damage you can do or not do to it. You know, how many times have you done something where you'd expect to rip a chunk off and it doesn't happen? It just kind of stays there. Damage, it bruises and it hurts and maybe a bit of bleeding or whatever, but it stays intact, generally speaking, right? Why does that happen? The other thing is, as I said, skin is generally waterproof. So how does that happen? It's the way the cells are actually stuck together. So we said that epithelial tissue, where in connective tissue you might have a cell here and a cell here and lots of stuff in between, in epithelial tissue, cells are, those membranes are right up to each other. So we need strength, so there are ways that the cells are glued together, if you want to use that term for now, okay? Which makes them much stronger, able to resist a lot more abrasions and those sorts of things. As I said, you wipe out on a bike and get road rash, it's not like it all disappears. Right, you get damage, but there's still a lot of skin that's still intact, right?
Why is it the elderly? Like, what happens?
Collagen.
Okay.
So all the money that you ladies spend for your collagen, getting back from, you know, Shoppers Drug Mart, it doesn't work. Because at the end of the day, all of us, the ages that we're getting to now, you're going to lose the collagen, your skin's going to get thin. So the question is, as a male, why doesn't my skin generally get as thin as yours? No, because ours was thicker in the first place.
Oh.
Yeah.
You can?
No, no, no. Right. Yeah, and even then, there's no guarantee it's going to get migrated to the area that it's, you know, whatever, right? The only way you can get collagen where it's supposed to go is if they take it out of here and put it in here. That's collagen, right? When you get the fillers. And they can also, as a... I'm assuming it's real collagen that they put in. I don't think it's synthetic, so I think you're able to buy collagen on the shelf, so to speak, that the plastic surgeon would use to fill all those sorts of things.
So the collagen, that's why they're more susceptible to shearing and things like
Yes, because they're losing, like, so if you look at your grandmother almost looks, she has tissue paper on the back of her hands, correct? And that's because all the collagen is gone because we just don't produce it as much anymore. And it just gets so thin because we're living so long that anything, like I said, that one lady that was leaking because she was on corticosteroids, I did phlebotomy on her. And when I put the needle in to take blood, the area where the needle penetrated the skin, it split.
Yeah, steroids thin the skin. I know that.
Yeah, very much so. Correct. That's why they always tell the tiniest amount.
Yeah.
Tiniest amount. So, how does tissue hold together, and why doesn't our skin just break apart? So we can see here we have a cell, and we can see there are a number of areas where cells are connected, and we're going to talk about every one of them. Okay, you can see they're all here, and you may want to use these these two slides to kind of remember them and what we're going to talk about. So cellular junction are, we think of them as specialized areas of cells where they do connect and touch each other. They can be found in muscle and nerve tissue, but we don't usually tend to find them in connective tissue. This is kind of related more to epithelial tissue more than anywhere. They're the most prominent in epithelial tissue, and there are five types. And I do call them by both names. And I can ask exam questions for both names because they tend to go back and forth pretty easily between authors and anatomy books. So either known as zona occludens or tight junctions. Does anybody here weld? Any welders? What's that look like? Spot welding, right? So think of it like that. It's actually like spot welding. Okay? So if you spot weld, how strong is that?
Not very strong.
Yeah, it's quite, right? So it's the same idea. So it's a zonar band between two adjacent cell membranes in which portions of the two membranes actually touch each other. So think of two cells and the two membranes are touching each other. It does limit passage of compounds between the cells, and the transport between the cells is improved at the locations of the spot welds, but not in the other places. So if you look at the picture here, you're not going to get much movement here, but you're going to get lots more movement here. So if we've got cell A on this side, cell B on this side, anything that can pass between the cells finds it much easier at these junctions and not so much here where there's space between the cell membranes. Does that make sense? They're not attached, so they don't communicate quite as well. Okay? They're found close to the apical surface of the cell, so think of you're welding the tops of your skin together. The cells are kind of welded together. They're especially found in the epithelium of the GI tract and the urinary bladder, and this is what helps make your tissue waterproof. So by having the cells so tightly connected together, they become almost waterproof. And right, you know, if you think about it, quite a lot of those kind of organs were used to carry water and things like way back when, right? When there wasn't glass or those sorts of things, they would work with the organs of the gut, and they would make like leather out of them and then use them for carrying drinking water because they were able to remain waterproof. What's that? Yeah, but they used to even use, like, they'd use the bladder of camels in the desert, and they would, you know, treat them, kind of make them like a leather, and that's, they would carry water in those, right, because they're waterproof. Okay, so that's the tight junctions. The next are called zona adherens or adherens junctions. Now, these are zones between the adjacent cells' membranes which help bind the cells together, but here, the membranes don't touch. So here, the membranes are touching at those protein spots, and we can see here, the membranes don't touch, but they are glued together at this point. So in the space between the membranes, we find a glycoprotein compound, which can act as a binding compound. The majority of glues out there, what are they made of?
Horses.
Yeah, what are those horses things made of? Yeah, which is what I tell you everything is about? Proteins. Most of your glues are proteins. So this is an example where at the cellular level, transmembrane glycoproteins, known as cadherin, act as a glue between the cell membranes, but the membranes don't touch. Okay? Okay. The cytoplasmic surface of the cell membrane has a light plaque on its surface which binds it. So let's look at the picture. You'll see that you've got your protein here, your transmembrane proteins. Do you see how it's sort of embedded into the cell membrane? Yes? You see that? No, the transmembrane protein here, the green, you can see how part of it penetrates through the cell membrane, correct? We then have this plaque that acts like a glue which the transmembrane proteins are anchored into. Yes?
So they only show up when there's plaque there. If there was no plaque there, it wouldn't be anchored like that?
This is the anchor. This is what the anchor is made of. You have a transmembrane protein, then you have a plaque that the transmembrane protein or glue is anchored into on the cytoplasmic side. Then you wouldn't have this, you wouldn't have an adherence junction. So this is the makeup of it, right? So we have an adherence junction here. We have a protein that's sort of gluing together. The membranes don't touch. The bases of the tails of that transmembrane protein are buried in this plaque on the cytoplasmic side. To further strengthen it, you see something else in the plaque. Microfilaments. So we want to build a mud hut. If we wanted to build a mud hut, how do we make a mud hut stronger?
Adding straw.
Adding straw, like a rebar in concrete. Same idea here. By adding fibers within the plaque, it becomes that much stronger. Okay? They're more like horsehair plaster when you're doing a house. One of the reasons why we put horsehair in the plaster, it made it so much stronger to have horsehair in the plaster. Right? Which is horrible stuff when you're doing home renovations and you find you've got it in your house if you've never done it. Ugh. Okay, so we have transmembrane proteins that act as a binding compound. On the cytoplasmic surface of the cell membrane, there's a light plaque on the surface which binds to the microfilaments of the cytoplasm and allows the transmembrane protein to anchor into it. Like it's like a glue on the inside of the cell. This type of junction is found just inferior to the zona occludens. So the zona occludens, the cell membranes touch, makes the tissue waterproof. Below that, they're also glued together with these adherence junctions. Okay? The next one is called a gap junction. This is not a zone or a belt, but it is a spot. So we see a spot on the cell. When we go back here, we can see we have this, again, this glue, this transmembrane protein anchored into this plaque, and then these fibers. Here, we actually have a spot of connection. The cell membranes, again, do not touch, right? They don't touch, but instead there are small protein channels, which are called connexons, they sort of bridge that gap in between. Okay, so you have to think of these little protein tubes that sort of connect the two membranes. They don't touch, but you got these little tubes running back and forth, okay? Now, why are they there? Because they allow ions and small molecules to pass very quickly from one cell to another. They're deliberately there. They open and close, which allows certain things to pass from one cell to the other without having to go through the cell membrane. Think of it as like a little subway tunnel that runs across from one cell to the other. Where that is very important is when we're talking about action potentials. So when the message gets sent from the nervous system for a muscle to contract, we don't want any hindrance of that action potential traveling down a muscle cell, especially in the heart. We see these in the heart, so that the action potential travels very quickly throughout the myocardial cells, and we get to the naked eye what looks like a single contraction, when in fact it's starting one place and spreading throughout the heart. And this kind of modification is what allows that to pass very quickly from one cell to the next. Okay? Cancer cells do not have gap junctions, and therefore intracellular communication is poor, and this is why the tumor cells can just grow, because there's no communication between the cells. Everybody just growing and multiplying until it gets too far, so to speak. So we can see here are our connexons here, these little tubes. Like I said, they can open and close, where things like ions and action potentials can pass very quickly between cells. The next one is called a desmosome. The desmosome looks very similar to the adherence, correct? Very similar to the adherence. So they are spot areas, not zones. So when we go back here to adherence, we can see this is a zone. It's going to travel all the way along that cell membrane. Whereas when we look at desmosomes, it's a single spot. But it's very similar. You still have a protein kind of gluing between the membranes, and the membranes don't touch. They bury through the membrane, and there is also a plaque that the transmembrane proteins anchor into. But it's a stronger, thicker plaque. And then instead of microfilaments within the plaque, we have intermediate filaments, which are thicker and far stronger. So this is a really powerful connection between cells. So they're similar to adherence, but they're spot areas, not zones. The cell membranes are not joined, and in fact, the intracellular space is wider as compared to adherence. So there's a lot more space between the membranes. The glycoprotein compound in the intracellular space, is much thicker and stronger, or is much lighter in the adherence form. It's much thicker here. And there's a fairly thick plaque that attaches to the cytoplasmic side of the cell membrane and is connected to intermediate filaments of the cytoplasm. So obviously, this is a very powerful connection between cells. Very strongly holds them together. And, of course, these intermediate filaments just provide even more strength. So this is a very powerful way that cells can connect together and not get pulled apart. The last one, the fifth one, is called the hemidesmosome. What does hemi mean? Right. So when we look here, this is one way that cells anchor into the basement membrane. So because we're talking about the basement membrane, there isn't another half. There's only one half that glues to the basement membrane. Okay? There isn't one on the other side. So they're found on the basal surface of the epithelial cells next to the basement membrane. Because there is no corresponding desmosome in the basement membrane, and it's only half, we call it a hemidesmosome on the one half. So this is how the basilar surface of a cell glues onto the basement membrane. So far, so good. And you can see it here. These are just depending, again, structure governs function. Do we want to make it waterproof? Do you know, and how strongly do we need to hold those cells together? I would suggest that, you know, when it comes to your skin, you want to have some good, powerful adhering between the cells of the skin, right? Okay? All right. So let's go to epithelial tissue. So what we're going to do when we do these classifications, okay, we need to look at the types that we have, okay? So in the simple tissue, so there are four types of simple tissue, and we need to ask ourselves, what's it look like? What's its function? And where in the body do we find it? And that's how I'm going to introduce you to all of them, okay? Right? What they look like, what their function is, and where the heck do we find this type of epithelial tissue in the human body? And that is the way I ask questions. So, simple squamous epithelium. We've talked about it a little bit. It's a single layer of squamous cells with the primary function of filtration and diffusion. We talked about a little bit of, you know, the relationship in the lung. It's unable to protect. It's not strong enough to protect. It's not strong enough to be able to do that. It is found in the lining of the alveoli of the lungs, amongst other places. So, of course, because it allows for filtration and diffusion, the reason we find it in the alveoli is because that's where we get gaseous exchange of carbon dioxide or oxygen when we're looking at the respiratory system. There are some special types of this tissue. The first special type is called endothelium, and this lines all the parts of the cardiovascular system. So it lines the inner layer of the heart, and it lines all the blood vessels, so and lymphatics, and it forms the walls of the capillaries. There's a reason why we need this. I'll just say it this way because we'll talk about it when we get the cardiovascular system. Blood doesn't like getting jiggled around. It likes to smoothly move through blood vessels. What this special endothelial tissue does, I call it like Teflon. It allows red blood cells to flow through the cardiovascular system smoothly without getting irritated. As long as red blood cells aren't irritated, they don't clot. One of the reasons why you get a clot, like say with a heart attack, is because you have plaque formation. Red blood cells kind of bounce around because it's narrowed, and once they bounce around, well, they get all jittery, and you get a clotting mechanism, and then you form a clot. So sometimes, yeah, well, still, yeah, because it stops. It doesn't like that either. The other type is this mesothelium, and we know it already. We've already talked about it a bit, and that's the serous membranes of the body. And this type of special, simple epithelium is responsible for creating the serous fluid that allows everything to slip and slide inside the gut or the lungs, right? So we see we've got basement membrane, connective tissue, and a single layer. In this case, this is simple squamous because of the shape of the cell. Then we have, you know, as I said, that's in the lung tissue for gaseous exchange. And it lines all the other parts of the cardiovascular system and also is part of the serous membranes that we know and we talked about previously. The next is called simple cuboidal. So again, connective tissue, basement membrane, and a single layer of cuboidal cells. Its primary function is secretion and absorption. This is found in the linings of the ovaries and the smaller ducts of many glands. So it is these cells that produce many of the things that we secrete, shall we say. No, this is still exocrine. So it would be some of the slippery stuff that we... Yes, correct. Right. Okay, so we can see it here. Cuboidal shape, simple single layer on top. The next is simple columnar. There are two types. There is non-ciliated and ciliated. Remember we talked about cilia, that hair-like... power stroke, and so forth. So, non-ciliated is a single layer of columnar cells which function as secretive and absorbive cells. This is what we find in the GI tract from the stomach to the anus. So, again, if we're thinking about absorption and secretion, well, What do we need to secrete in the gut? All the way to the end, yeah? Sometimes, what else? There's more special cells that are called chief cells. Mucus 4, correct, which allows food materials to slide through and have no problem at all whatsoever. They're found in the lungs, as I said, they're usually on top of them, though, are microvilli. So we have villi and microvilli, and all that's doing is increasing surface area. So if we take a villi and we go like this, where's the white? I'm just going to take one simple, there's the villi, okay? Now on the villi, we have microvilli. So when we look at this in the small intestine, we have one, and then one, and then one, and then one. That's the whole lining. And then on top of that are microvilli. We are just extrapolating surface area, making it larger and larger and larger for absorption, right, when we're eating and moving food stuff through. In between these columnar cells, we find something called goblet cells, and goblet cells secrete mucus. So whether that's mucus within the respiratory system or mucus in the gut, as we said, provides lubrication for food materials to travel through the gut. So we can see here we've got villi and microvilli on top, and then we've got these mucus membranes that sort of sit in between. And mucus is made of protein. The ciliated type is a single layer of columnar cells, and they have cilia on the apical surface instead of villi. And, of course, this is about moving compounds over the surface of the epithelium. There are goblet cells as well here because goblet cells will pick up things that are moving through and hold on to them. And the mucus that's created by the goblet cells is what we move forward to, say, cough up, for example, to get rid of. The tissue is found in lining some of the respiratory tract, the fallopian tubes in the uterus. Why the fallopian tubes? Right. It's the cilia that bring the egg once it's crossed over into the from the ovary. It's these that move the ovum down through into the uterus, right? Yeah, crowd serving. Now, the pseudostratified, of course, as I said, it is a single layer. It does have different heights, but they all touch the basement membrane. Under the microscope, it does look stratified, but in fact, they are not. It's just that some don't reach the apical surface. There's usually cilia on the apical surface, and, of course, you have goblet cells. And this type of pseudostratified is what we mostly find in the respiratory tract. The non-ciliated type is found lining the epididymis and part of the eustachian tube. The eustachian tube is in the ear, and it's part of the fluid that we need to drain off our ear. And the epididymis is part of the male reproductive tract where immature sperm are created to go off and up a little bit higher to mature. Correct. The microvilli are just kind of hanging out surface area. Okay. It's a cilia that... Yeah. Okay. Now, that was simple. Now we have stratified. Remember, stratified tissue, more than two layers, and we name it according to its most apical cell shape. Okay? So, we have stratified squamous, stratified cucuboidal, stratified columnar, and transitional. Same idea, we need to describe it, what's its function, and where in the body do we find it. So stratified squamous, we have underlying cuboidal cells, usually within those deeper layers, and then the upper layers are squamous. This is our skin. Okay, so we have cuboidal cells and that are creating things down below, and as cells move up to the apical surface, they become more and more squamous, flat in nature, okay? The upper layers are squamous. It has a high turnover weight, so they're dying and being replaced constantly. So as apical cells are lost, basal cells are moving up to fill in the spots. Every time, just putting your shirt on today, wiping yourself with your towel after you had your shower to dry, you're just ripping off millions of cells off that apical surface of your skin. Right? Anybody here go to spas and get salt glows and all that kind of stuff where they rub you with salt?
Yeah. Brian, come on.
Yeah, but You did something before you got here, right? Has anybody here ever had a salt glow? They're awesome, aren't they? So when I went to school, the school I went to was called the Canadian College of Massage and Hydrotherapy. So I am completely trained in wraps, salt glows, Blitz gusses. Blitz gusses were fun. A blitz gus. A high pressure hose, high pressure hose of ice cold water, and you stand in your bathing suit, and I just beat the hell out of you with this water doing
That's what they do
circles
for
and.
the, they do those massages for women.
Yeah, we're not trying to get rid of lice or anything. No, we just said very particular patterns that you would use. Yeah. Yeah. No, we used to do wraps too. So I would take soaking wet, ice cold cotton sheets and put you on a massage table and wrap you up tight as hell and put blankets on top. Within about 15 minutes, you're swimming in your own sweat. Yeah. No. I put cold and just let, and your body will react to the cold, and you just profusely sweat. It's supposed to get rid of toxicities and stuff. No, yeah, but then you're gonna drink water because you're dehydrated, right? Oh, we had Russian saunas, like you sat in one of those boxes and just your head sticks out. I'm trained in all that stuff. Just didn't know use any of it. Never used any of it anymore. But that's what I used to be. Massage used to be. That was a big thing in our scope of practice was all this hydrotherapy stuff. Yeah. It is. Yeah, they're still there. Yeah. Yeah. So, we've got these many, many cells, cuboidal deep to squamous apically, and cells are always being turned over. There's two types. There is keratinized stratified squamous epithelium and non-keratinized squamous epithelium. Now, the idea being that, first and foremost, when you have stratified, that's all about protection, right? It's a tougher type of epithelial tissue. It can take shearing forces, it can take friction, those sorts of things. So the keratinized stratified, you have another protein called keratin that embeds itself within the cell itself. In fact, when we learn about the integumentary system, deep in your skin, in the epidural layer, you do have live cells. But as they travel to the apical surface, they start getting impregnated with the protein keratin. By the time they get to the top, they're completely dead, they have no organelles, and it's a cell that's completely full of keratin, and that's it. A real tough protein, hence the reason why that apical surface is so much tougher. So, the protein keratin is deposited on the cells, surface cells. It forms the outer layer of the skin. It does act as a waxy coat, and it does make the skin waterproof. Yeah, it's one of the layers of the skin that gets thicker and thicker and thicker as a reaction to friction. When I get the skin, I'll talk about it because I always chuckle at women who use the pumice stone to get rid of their calluses on their feet, when in fact calluses are actually a reaction to friction. So what are you doing with the pumice stone? Right. Oh, said I wonder. I should have invented women's products. Makeup and that. I watch women in Shoppers Drug Mart and they have like bag full of stuff. Now the other type of stratified is non-keratinized, but remember stratified is still a protective type of epithelial tissue. So the non-keratinized, we do want protection, but we don't want hardness. Does that make sense? Right? Like your regular skin. So this tends to be found in the moist areas of the body. It does line the mouth, the anus, vagina, and tongue. And it makes sense, right? Because there's many things we can think about that involve those areas that there's various amounts of friction and the skin is, demanded to go under a lot of stress, and it's again adapted to be able to deal with that, right? Okay?
So non-keratinized would be like your mucous membrane.
Yeah, yes. Right. So your tongue, you're eating food and it's smashing around in there and doing all kinds of things, right? So we can see here, again, this is kind of our skin. We've got columnar here at the most basal layer here. And as we work our way up, they're becoming flatter and flatter and flatter. And by the time we get to the apical surface, we have four or five layers of flattened squamous cells that are completely full of keratin. And that's what represents our epithelial layer. stratified cuboidal. We have two or more layers of cuboidal cells in there. It is pretty uncommon in the human body. It is found lining the ducts of adult sweat glands and part of the male urethra. The sweat glands, I get, I'm not particularly sure about the male urethra. I'm not sure what that would provide to that. I know as males, I mean, our urethra is obviously longer than the ladies' is, right? I don't know if maybe that's part of it. It is a secretory type of cell, so I'm not sure. I'm not sure why it's there. Found lining, sorry, and the primary function, of course, is protection. But it's not. It's in the male. I know. Pardon? That's what I'm wondering, too, possibly. Yeah, but it still would be a moist area of the body, right? You know, because it's still, you know, you've got urine that's traveling through there and it is within the inside of the body. So, I don't know. Stratified columnar, two or more layers with the surface layer being columnar, of course. Extremely important in protection. So, we've got, you know, big, tall cells, a couple layers of them. So, quite thick from a microscopic tissue perspective. Found lining part of the male urethra, large excretory ducts and portions of the anus. The tissue also functions in secretion. So that kind of makes a bit of sense, right? You know, when you're defecating, going to the bathroom, of course you do want some lubrication there. And, you know, quite often people who have constipation, their main reason for constipation is because the feces stays too long in the bowel. All the water gets absorbed out of the fecal matter and it's so dry that the patient can't get that fecal matter through. So this is why you need to sometimes have an enema to provide some moisture into the area. Some of the medications that are taken softens the feces so that it's easier to leave the body. So, yeah, what you do, if you guys haven't done abdominal massage, have you? I used to hate abdominal massage eyes in school. We finished the routine and I'd be like, I'd have to go to the bathroom as quick as possible because it works really, really well. Yeah, that's right. It's really good, though, for people who are, like, quadriplegics, those sort of folks who have problems with going to the bathroom. Abdominal massage, we do this whole technique where we actually follow the colon. We first go backwards to break it all up, and then we go forwards to promote fecal movement of fecal matter, and it really works. Transitional. The appearance of the cells varies, as I said. It goes from stratified squamous to stratified cuboidal, depending on how stretched the tissue is. And, of course, the primary function of this is to stretch and get larger. And it's found lining the urinary bladder and portions both of the urethra and the ureters. It is that stretching of the bladder and its relationship to the nervous system that makes you go, oh, I got to go pee, because you're getting bladder distension. And, of course, the more that distends, the more you go, now I really have to go. Right, and so on, right? Okay. Because what you're doing is you're increasing pressure, pushing down on the bladder, making it feel more distended, and it just, from the nervous system reflex arc, it just is, the more it feels stretchy, the more the brain goes, you really gotta pee right now. Okay. Glandular epithelium. So I said the other role for epithelium is the glands of the body, and the primary function, of course, of glands is secretion. A gland can be as small as a single cell or up to millions of cells within the size of the gland. And, of course, there are two major classifications. First are exocrine glands and endocrine glands, so those that secrete outwardly and those that are within. So, exocrine. They secrete their products onto the apical surface. So think of oil on your skin or sweating. So you have pores in your skin where cells are producing these products. They're traveling up through the pore, and they're coming out on the apical surface of the skin itself. Again, sweat or oil, it doesn't make any difference. Hence the reason why they're exo, is because they come out onto that apical surface. So the types of secretion are mucus, oil, wax in the ears, and enzymes. So we have sweat glands, salivary glands, what else we got? And mammary glands. Mammary glands are... right, our type of exocrine gland as well, because cells are producing the milk and then secreting them outside the body, right? They can be further classified in structure by breaking down into unicellular and multicellular. A unicellular gland, exocrine gland, is your goblet cell. Each cell is producing small amounts of mucus, and all of them together can produce vast amounts. Whereas something like your sweat glands, you have a lot of cells that are secreting that sweat at any given time within that gland. Now, we're not going to need to know all of these, but I just show you this, that, you know, when we look at, for example, pimples or blackheads, what's happening there? Right. Well, you'll notice what you call a pore anatomically is actually called a duct. So you've got something that plugs this area here, and of course, then deep to that, you get an inflammatory response because it's blocked, right? So any of these can, and you can see how when you start looking at the different configurations of them, the potential for plugging it gets higher the more complicated the gland gets, correct?
Would you say that the ones in our face are more complicated than the rest of
the face? No, there are a whole bunch of different types. And you can have lots of problems at any given time. Any of them can be plugged for various reasons. Right, that's those are your oil glands, and during puberty, especially for males, of course, because of the varying changes in hormones, you get massive overproduction of oil, and the ducts almost can't keep up with it. Hence the reason why, you know, the dirt on the skin gets plugged up, gets all mushed up with the oil, and then it plugs the pore, and then away you go with an infection and inflammation and so forth.
Nothing really to do with the actual dust formation itself.
Well, yeah, you can get a little more complicated. So I think it's the simple coil that I think you find in the ear. You know, sometimes anybody get blackheads in their ears sometimes, right? And I think it's because of that twist kind of thing. Yeah, because again, the configuration, they plug much easier as compared to other areas as far as that goes. Exocrine glands secrete their compounds by one to three routes. First is called a holocrine gland. Now, holocrine glands release their compounds by releasing an entire cell. So cells get created within the gland. They travel to the apical surface of that gland. And when the product is needed, that cell breaks away and floats up through the duct and then bursts once it kind of gets out into the open space of the gland, which then ends up out on the skin. Okay? So the glands release their compounds by the entire cell, and then the compound to be released is in the cytosol of that gland. So that gland, the cell within that gland is responsible for creating whatever the compound is within its own cytosol. And then when the membrane breaks, then it releases what was in the cytosol. So this is your oil glands. So within your duct and in your gland here, you can, these small cells in here will fill up with oil, and then they break away from that, and then they fill this up with oil once the membrane breaks, and then that oil will leave via the duct onto the skin. And oil is vitally important to the health of the skin. You know, this whole idea that we do in our society where we're showering every day and scrubbing and doing whatever to get rid of oils, that oil is actually there, and it is somewhat healthy to some degree. I mean, what do they say? You shouldn't wash your hair every day. You should only wash it, what, three times a week or something like that? Yeah, you want those natural oils. What's that?
Once a week.
Is it what? Yeah.
I had a teacher who actually, funny, she looked at
it.
She's like, how often do you think I wash my hair? And we were like, every day. And she's like, no, I wash it once a week.
Yeah.
Actually, less oil build up from washing her hair once a week than if she did it every
single day. So you can see here then, we've got cellular division that happens here. The cell then creates the compound within the membrane, and then the membrane breaks apart, and the material that was in the cytosol then gets released into the gland itself and then leaves the gland via the duct to get out onto that apical surface. The next is called an apocrine gland. This type of gland has the material accumulate at the apical part of the gland that faces the inside of the duct. Okay? The apical portion then gets pinched off, which is containing the compound that the cell has created, and then the apical portion goes off into the area of the gland, and then of course that material gets secreted out the duct, and then back behind it, the cell that got pinched off, it repairs, and then will go on to reproduce more of the compound yet again to pinch off and release and repair and produce more, pinch off, release, and so forth, right? So this is your mammary glands and your sweat glands. We'll do this. You can see here you've got, look at that, you've got a nucleus, and what is that? Endoplasmic reticulum, and what is that? the Golgi apparatus, which is creating the vesicles that migrate to the membrane, and then away they go. Miracling glands, they do their creation and removal of the materials within the cell through exocytosis. So therefore, only the compounds released, and there's no damage to the cell membrane. So in the first kind, the whole cell just bursts apart and it's done. The second type, the apical surface of the cell pinches off. And this type is just the compound gets released through exocytosis. It is the most common form of exocrine gland secretion, and this would represent our salivary glands. And how often here have you had the salivary, the squirt? Yeah, especially when you're really hungry or you get that whiff of something in your, it's just like, and what it's doing is the gland is deliberately lubricating the inside of the mouth because you've initiated a hunger going to eat thing, and the gland is just literally preparing the inside of the mouth to lubricate the mouth to be able to eat.
Do you know what the thing is where it's like a reaction, like if you're at the dentist,
they probably press on it. You can press on that gland and it will squirt. Yeah. Have you never had a salivary gland squirt? No, I have not. Makes sense, though. I mean, I'd be somewhat the same thing, I'm sure it would be. But no, you've never had, you're just so hungry and something smells so good on the barbecue, you just. Yeah. Well, it's the same as just what happens just before you vomit. Right? Again, the mouth is preparing to lubricate for what's coming. Now, endocrine glands, so exocrine was our oil, sweat, that kind of stuff. Endocrine glands, the reason they're called endocrine glands is because they release their compounds directly into the blood. Exocrine glands secrete their materials onto the apical surface of the epithelial tissue. Endocrine glands release their compounds directly into blood itself, okay? They don't have a duct, where exocrines do. And what these endocrine glands do, they secrete hormones. Okay, their whole role is to secrete hormones. So the hormones are chemicals which regulate the physiological processes of the body, and they are damn powerful. And this idea of playing around with them, you know, for performance enhancing, that kind of stuff, they're dangerous as hell because the body regulates them so well, too much of them, things can go really screwy. And I'm not just talking about performance-enhancing hormones, but, you know, you can get all these things that promotes excess testosterone in health food stores and whatever, and you need to be careful with some of that stuff because, again, excessive amounts can lead to all kinds of other problems.
Like, a lot of people don't really know what it does to their body. They're just taking things, someone says, oh, hey, I take...
Well, there's an aesthetic, right, sometimes that, you know, maybe an individual can't, for example, you know, you want to use an athlete there, just not quite fast enough. Look at Ben Johnson, right? Now, you still got to train your ass off, but it does help along the way. And you know, many of you are probably too young to remember Ben Johnson, but you know who Ben Johnson is? He's a sprinter. He's a 100-meter specialist. Won the gold medal at the Olympics. Broke the world record. The country went nuts. All us Canadians, 11 o'clock at night in front of the TV, screaming at him winning the gold medal on Saturday night, and he lost it Monday morning because he was full of steroids. Yeah. So, sex hormones are secreted by endocrine glands, testosterone, estrogen, thyroid hormones, which really affect metabolism, insulin in the pancreas for diabetes or not. That is, again, the pancreas is an endocrine gland that does secrete. It's an exocrine and an endocrine gland. It's kind of a unique gland. It does secrete compounds in digestion. It also secretes hormones for insulin control or for glucose control in the body. I said, some do both. Pancreas, the endocrine portion involves secretion of insulin and glucagon, and the exocrine portion secretes digestive enzymes and sodium bicarbonate into the GI tract.
Digestive enzymes are considered ectones?
Yes, because they go out into the apical surface of the epithelial lining of the lumen of the small intestine. What's that? I don't understand. Shaped like a donut? Yeah, so you have a tube. Your outer is epithelium. There's a muscle layer. And then there's an inner lining, right? Right there. Only it's squiggly like that. And that inner lining is also epithelial, right? And the whole thing rolls and just pushes one way, right? From stomach to anus, right? And as it travels through, it breaks things down. We absorb as it travels through until eventually all things work properly. What you're getting rid of, the body doesn't really need much of anymore. And so you've gotten what it needs out of it, and you just get rid of the leftovers. Okay, so when we come back next week, we'll be into connective tissue, correct? A connective tissue, other tissues, and then we start in the integumentary system, the skin. And for those who weren't here earlier,